This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Is Rove toast? Is Harriet salvageable? Can GM's health cutbacks save it? Plus, our patented Judy Miller watch. And in a just world, would Judd Gregg win the lottery? Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of our Santa Monica studio and the political spectrum is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the Los Angeles Times. On the right from Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, editorial page editor and columnist for the Washington Times and author of The West's Last Chance, Can We Win the Clash of Civilizations? And from the liberal or raging blogosphere is our own Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. Welcome all from across the country, across the political spectrum. A very busy week, topped as we went to air on Friday by what looked like news in the major newspapers that potential indictments of Karl Rove and even Louis Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, may be imminent. This is from lawyers close to the case, et cetera, et cetera. A big front page piece in the Washington Post already talking about the palpable silence at the White House and people looking toward how to even manage a post-Karl Rove era, talking about burnout among folks like Andy Card, the very long-serving and very hard-working chief of staff. Tony Blankley, you're at Ground Zero in the conservative cabal. Are you drinking earlier these days? Are you what's the pulse?
No, I'm not. I'm still on my diet, so I'm unfortunately not drinking. I think. As far as Rove is concerned, nobody seems to know anything, but the buzz certainly has grown to the point where either everybody is wrong or the buzz is right. And there's no doubt that if Rove were to be indicted, that it would require a restructuring of the president's staff. Now, I happen to think, and that increasingly Republicans in town have been clucking to each other. I was clucking just last night at a book party with a fellow clucker, that the president desperately needs to get a few new voices for him to be hearing, not necessarily permanent staffers, but some old hands who are friends politically and who are shrewd, because he is obviously in some very choppy water and the bunker mentality is setting in fairly deeply. So we may see, assuming, and as I say, I have no knowledge on it, but if in fact Rove is indicted, and I hope he's not, I hope he hasn't done anything to deserve that, then it may precipitate a needed internal reorganization.
Well, I think this is way bigger than the restructuring of the president's staff. You know, I'm sure that will be a major problem, but it's not exactly what's uppermost on my mind when I wake up. I think this is, if there are indictments, if, and we know that's a big if because we don't exactly know what's going to happen, we just hear a lot. But if there are indictments.
Doesn't stop us from talking.
No, absolutely not. But if there are indictments, this is going to be bigger than Watergate, because this ultimately is about how an entire nation was misled into war, and how when it turned out that there was no imminent threat, that this was an unnecessary war, all the president's men did everything they could to smear anyone who wanted to tell the truth, and how the media went along, especially the poster child, Judy Miller, and the New York Times. And this is going to lead to a lot more restructuring of politics, of traditional media, than the president's staff. And that's really where the blogosphere is coming in right now, because we've had this selling of everything for the sake of access. That is really what is the epitome of Blamegate. It's like you have journalists like Judy Miller who would basically were perfectly happy to trade their press pass for a White House access pass, And that was really the beginning of the New York Times becoming an enabler in the marketing of a war. And that's really at the heart of everything. You know, people can hide behind complexity, but in the end, this is a very simple story of the selling of the wrong war.
I just have to say, Ariana, that I will wager you a quality used SUV that this will not be bigger than Watergate.
I've got four
of them myself, and I don't know whether you have
any ready to hand. I'll wager you a Prius, a hybrid Prius.
Bob, do you want to get into this wager? Bigger than Watergate, Bob?
Well, you know, I should remind you, Watergate was not big for much of its life. It was a story that much of the mainstream media ignored, as in this case, without people like Ariana and others in the what she calls the blogosphere, this might have been hushed over. Certainly Judy Miller's heroics, or whatever they were, would not have been exposed in quite this way. What happened, as we all know about Watergate, was that the cover-up was worse than the original crime. It's the stonewalling. It's the deception. And maybe there is an echo here. I mean, first of all, substantively, this is far more important not only than Watergate, but certainly than Paula Jones or Whitewater or the things that drove the Clinton administration crazy, which, first of all, happened in the main before he was even president. And for all of those who are clucking now about this being rough trade with the White House and they're being put through this, remember, the Clinton administration was destroyed over stuff that he and his wife were alleged to have done before he was even president. This is a real issue, and it's a real issue because national security is supposed to be the big thing that we're concerned about. That's what's supposed to justify all of the other failures of this administration. That's what's the reason why we all get searched and every other which way. And yet it turns out on the absolute most critical matter of national security, the ability of a CIA covert agent to pursue the reality of weapons of mass destruction, to work in a confidential way, risk her own life, working she didn't have any government protection, working with other people around the world to track down weapons of mass destruction. And this administration was quite willing to throw her overboard in a way in an effort to smear her husband. And so it shows that they're not the least bit serious about the thing that they claim to be most serious about.
Let me get in for a second. Because the thing that sounds like is going to happen, though, and I understand perfectly why Bob and Ariana want to make this about the broader war issue. But it looks like, you know, if you can credit what the reports are from the lawyers who are leaking at this point, is that if there's an indictment, it's going to be the kind of stuff that happens as a result of the investigation. It's the obstruction of justice or the perjury. It's the stuff like Clinton lying about whether, he had dealt with Monica Lewinsky, you know, in a way that's perjury to the court long after the facts of what you think the crime was supposed to be have to do with. So I guess what are we going to learn now? Yes, those who say there's no difference between the parties are wrong because Democrats lie about sex and Republicans lie about power, right? But in both cases, we're going to end up crucifying folks for stuff afterwards. I'm not saying you don't have to deal with courts honestly, but it's a little weird. Go ahead.
Let me just make a couple of very quick points. First of all, I don't deprecate the inconsequence of leaking the name of a covert operator. I didn't at the time, and I still don't. If that's been done, then it's a very serious felony.
But we don't know if that's the case.
Neither do I deprecate the minimalism of perjury. If perjury is charged and there's evidence for it, that's a serious felony. My point is it's not a presidential scandal unless the president has been doing that. And in this case, it's a staffer who is being alleged. In the case of Clinton and in the case of Nixon, it was the president himself, which is why, of course, they were presidential scandals.
Yes, but first of all, as we read in Friday's Los Angeles Times, certainly Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, was so involved and so engaged that nobody believes that Dick Cheney wasn't in some way involved, whether he'll be indicted or whether he'll be in any way mentioned.
Believe.
We don't know. But here we have, you know, okay.
But
the
you're saying if it's Cheney, it's a presidential scandal in effect.
Well, exactly. Because, you know, we know that Cheney does not spend 3 hours a day working out, and he's actually involved in every detail. And he's suddenly gone AWOL. I don't know when was the last time we heard about him or from him. So there is some kind of involvement, whether it will lead to any legal repercussions or not, we don't know. But politically, if his chief of staff is indicted, it absolutely gets to the vice president. And here, you know, for me, you know, Michael Isikoff has a great blog on the Huffington Post this morning in which he says that the most serious thing that was not really given a lot of attention is that Libby lied to Judy Miller about the national intelligence estimate, which was basically that he told her, trust me, if you knew what I knew, if you could read this top secret reports, it's much worse than anybody knows. And that's really the way they solved that war and they solved the cover-up to reporters. And yet you have Judy Miller saying that he was a good faith source despite all the lies.
But all that would be true if there was no investigation going on about any
But we would not be discussing it. That's the difference.
Well, go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I do think it is a presidential scandal because, first of all, the thing that started this whole thing was the president being misinformed or lying or whatever the right word is, and in turn deceiving the American public in a State of the Union speech about the uranium attempt to purchase uranium in Nigeria. Joe Wilson, the third, came in the crosshairs of the administration because he said, wait a minute, they were informed this was not the case. And then when he tried to go public with this and went public, that's when this administration and the two top aides, Rove and Libby, you know, maybe Nixon's fault is he didn't delegate enough to Haldeman, you know, I don't know. But you know, you're certainly not going to, if you've got the two top aides, the vice president and the president, doing this dirty work of destroying somebody who exposed the president's deception in a speech, that is a presidential scandal. Let's not kid ourselves.
But it was discredit. I mean, they were trying to – look, I'm not condoning it, but again, White Houses since the beginning of time try and discredit people who are their political opponents. If there was a crime committed, there's no question that's a huge problem. But it's also standard operating procedure.
Isn't it odd that you would discredit – you would discredit the distinguished ambassador who was praised
he's
by
not,
Bush's
anyway, – he's not distinguished.
Let's not relive the whole –
But praised by Bush's father for standing up to Saddam, you would discredit him by saying that his wife is a covert CIA agent. My God, what happened to patriotism?
You're right. If that was done, that's wrong.
But one second. I mean, I'm letting a lot of this stuff pass in the interest of trying to get to another topic at some point.
Yes.
But even the Senate intelligence 9/11 Commission found that Wilson was not an honest operator. He misstated, you know, a number of things, including his claim initially that Cheney had sent him there, and they proved that he had not and didn't even know he'd gone there. Let's not call Wilson a noble figure. Whatever it is that President Bush's staffers have done, we'll judge objectively, but to lift Wilson up to this point of nobility is overreaching.
Let's go to Harriet Myers, because we're not going to have time to refight the entire Joe Wilson thing. We'll see what's happening with that probably as soon as next week. But Harriet Myers continues to be a huge problem increasingly for the White House. I think everybody knows why. So, Tony, are they going to pull her? Are they going to? Charles Krauthammer had an interesting column on Friday with his face-saving gambit was that the Senate could insist on getting the so-called privileged materials because it would be the only way to judge what kind of counsel she gave the president, which might be the only thing that would give any information on what she thinks about anything. She would refuse to do that, or the White House would refuse, because that would be inappropriate somehow for executive privilege, and then Harriet would withdraw gracefully somehow, clearing the way for another person. Does that have any is that crazy?
It's too late for grace. But look, I have no idea what the president's thinking or doing, but I become increasingly suspicious that this thing will never result in her confirmation. Every day, more people who ought to be friendly to her on general party principles are uttering more and more concerns. I think this is something that – this is a nomination that is increasingly likely to implode at some point.
Will it get to hearings? It seems so. I'm sure she's a nice woman, but you look at the – she didn't even fill out her book report properly, right? The thing that she sent over, both Democrats and Republicans, right, Specter and Leahy, said this is – you didn't fill out the form right.
She was too busy writing thank you notes to George Bush. I mean, like the note that we saw today in the LA Times on Friday.
Which
it was really about – there was a really interesting piece about the – the value of flattering your superiors. it is all, if you really flatter well enough, you end up being nominated to the Supreme Court. But I just had an email sent to me from a friend who said that he's actually looking for a sign of intelligent resign. And I think that's
right. A sign of intelligent what?
Resign.
Resign.
Oh. Yes.
Check with the Discovery Institute.
Yeah, checking emails during the show, that's the real scandal I think we're talking about. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I don't know how I got left being the only Harriet Myers defender on this show, but let me just say, first of all, on this question of her qualification, she certainly is more qualified than Clarence Thomas was, and that was not the big no-no there. And I'm a little worried about some of these qualified people. For instance, the person just picked to be the Chief Justice is a person who seems to condone torture and go along with the administration's thinking of those matters. And the people who have defended him and attacked Harriet Myers seem to think there is no constitutional barrier to torture. So I think some very skilled lawyers who worked in the Justice Department in the White House in the last few years were skilled at destroying any sense of human rights and any adherence of those human rights to the U.S. Constitution in a very skilled way. Maybe Harriet Myers is a bit more down to earth. Maybe she's not as polished and smooth, about it. But I would give one example. The thing that bothers me about Harriet Myers is that she would not condemn the Texas sodomy law. That bothers me because that was basically a way of criminalizing homosexual behavior. But Scalia, who was held up by George Bush as the model for the court, is the guy who voted against repealing, against calling it unconstitutional on the Supreme Court. So if we're going to get a Scalia-type appointee, I suspect it'll be worse than Myers.
Up ahead, more on Harriet, the future of General Motors, plus random redistribution of wealth. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Scheer is with me on the left. Tony Blankley is in Washington on the right. And Arianna Huffington, also here in Santa Monica and somewhere beyond. Let's finish up with Harriet Myers. You know, I don't know Harriet Myers, but I do, you try and empathize with somebody going through a situation like this where they've essentially been totally obscure. And suddenly, because of the media machine that comes in, you're not only a household word, but you're also in a way being diminished and humiliated almost daily. And it's a I don't want to have any dark forebodings, but I remember when Vince Foster was in the White House, someone who came from a smaller town environment and ended up, the object of these scornful Wall Street Journal editorials accusing him of criminality. And I'm not saying anything like that, but there is something to the the lens, the intensity that gets focused on people in ways that I think are hard. Bob, did you want to lend an empathetic note to that?
First of all, I'm in agreement with Laura Bush on this. I think some of the attacks on this woman are sexist. First of all, by normal standards, I think she's had a successful career. I don't like lawyers that work for corporations primarily, but that's what Hillary Clinton did, and she in fact made the famous statement or infamous statement once, you can't be a successful lawyer without working for banks. Okay, Harriet Myers was a very successful corporate lawyer. She became head of the Texas Bar, and by normal standards, this woman would be highly regarded in terms of the profession, and yet she's being slammed all over. Why? Because she's, I don't know what, not more male-like, or she's not, doesn't have five children following after her with a dutiful husband taking care of them. I think the woman is getting a raw deal.
Well, look, I mean, given that the conservatives who have been criticizing her had a list of four other women, none of whom went to Ivy colleges, who they thought would be wonderful appointees, the sexism charge is absurd, and it outraged conservatives when Bush and his various spokespeople threw that traditional liberal canard at conservatives, and it was a foolish charge. But regarding what's happening to poor Miss Harriet, I'm reminded of the song lyrics from many years ago. It isn't very pretty what a town without pity can do.
What song is that? What song is that?
That is from a town without pity. I believe it had to do with, it was a Kirk Douglas movie I think, taking about a woman who had been raped in a defense trial in which her reputation was besmirched.
We invite listeners to correct us if we were wrong.
I could be wrong about the movie, but I'm correct about the lyrics. They resonate through my mind all these years later.
Well, you know, talk about segues. Detroit itself can be a town without pity. And look what's happened to General Motors and the UAW just this week. Big news on the heels of Delphi, one of the big suppliers, going bankrupt. The interim head of Delphi calling for dramatic, something like 2/3 cuts in the wages and benefits paid to current workers he says are necessary to make them competitive. And General Motors finally negotiating this long-expected rollback of retiree benefits in particular for General Motors to address their huge legacy costs. On the one hand, you know, and this is something I think we'll revisit in the months ahead, but there's this major issue of what does happen to middle class, less skilled jobs, where for decades, folks without fancy educations, even Harriet Myers types, could actually earn great livings and have secure benefits in retirement. And it looks like that may not work anymore in a global economy. And yet at the same time, if you look at the details of what the retirees are actually being asked to pay in copays and deductibles now, which I saw in the New York Times today, it's actually much less than what's done in the rest of America. So I don't even know if this is going to begin to get General Motors out of the hole. But Bob, you're reaching out to speak first. But for the labor side of the table, what does it mean? These are big issues that we won't do justice to today, but we can at least start.
Well, for me, it means two things. First of all, is the complete failure of leadership at General Motors and elsewhere in Detroit when it comes to the kind of technology that would have gotten them out of producing all the SUVs that Tony has been buying and others can hardly now sell second rate and second hand. And also, it's really the crisis in healthcare that we've talked about before and that you've written about, Matt, which is that basically a lot of the problems with GM, other than the problems of leadership and sticking to large SUVs, even when they knew that other technologies were available, have to do with the cost of healthcare, the mounting health cost of healthcare, and why there is absolutely an urgent necessity to address it as a nation, even if we only care about business and don't care about anything else.
Bob?
Yeah, I think here we've heard some really false arguments. And the headline on the Los Angeles Times yesterday, you know, this is the global economy and we just can't afford the very thing we most celebrate in America, the Tocqueville celebrated, which is a middle class of working artisans who can support themselves in dignity. That seems to be going. So the argument is, oh, we can't do that because we have all this cheap labor. Well, the fact is the American car manufacturers were not defeated by people who had cheap labor. German labor is not cheap. Japanese labor is not cheap. And in fact, in both of those societies, there was a great deal of worker protection, worker benefits, legacy protection, and so forth, and loyalty to the company as a result by those workers. So the argument that somehow the failure of the American automobile industry is a failure of a sort of mini welfare state, the phrase that ridiculously used in the Los Angeles Times, it should be challenged. This is not a case, as in some areas of agriculture or making T-shirts or something, where you can argue the cheap labor position. The fact is, this is a case of mismanagement on a grand level. Then what does Delphi do? They first spun off. They hide behind the bankruptcy laws. At a very time when we tell middle-class, working-class Americans, you can't use the old bankruptcy laws, but these people will hide behind it. They'll protect their perks. They'll get out of it looking great. They'll make big fees. The lawyers will make big fees. But you're telling these workers who signed on for a bargain of labor peace and productivity all those years, they're the ones that have to get sacrificed. But what really is at issue here, by the way, is not only the end of I think, the Republican con to the American working people, particularly in the Midwest, because it isn't happening, but in fact, really underpinning the major greatness of American society, which is we had working people who could have a dignified life.
Let me say one thing, Tony, before getting in, which is, Bob, I don't doubt there's mismanagement in terms of General Motors not making cars people want, but there is something else going on that we're going to have to – this may be subject for future shows, because it's not just the cost structure of those foreign suppliers like Toyota and others in America, and their American plants is much lower than the U.S. one. That's the kind of competition they're talking about that they have to be able to meet. And as empathetic as we should rightly be to workers who are finding out that they can't have packages worth $65 an hour in this kind of work anymore, it, I believe, isn't sustainable and probably isn't sustainable for these companies competing to have cost structures at that level. People get hurt by that, but the bigger question is, how are we going to make sure we have a society that gives enough people a chance to rise and enough people a chance to have the basics that every decent person ought to be able to have in a wealthy country like ours, even if industries change and jobs are at risk? Tony, briefly on this.
Well, the legacy cost is measurable, but on the other hand, GM, when it was producing products that people wanted to buy, was able to make a profit even with the legacy costs. So to a certain extent, Ariana is right that they have misjudged the market. They got overextended into a product line that of big vehicles, and now they're paying the price for not anticipating a market movement. As far as competing with European and Japanese health costs, I believe most of the European countries, the government picks up the health costs, so it's not part of the cost of operating an industrial plant, as it is here due to various quirks in our World War II tax codes that resulted in health care being provided by employers rather than by the government. But overall, whether the private sector or the public sector over the next 30 years, no one in Europe nor the United States is going to be – none of our countries will be able to afford to provide for all the retirement and health benefits that we promised ourselves.
We've only got 1 minute before we rant. Judd Gregg, the senator from New Hampshire, who's worth, according to his disclosure forms, between $2.5 million and $9 million, won in the Powerball lottery, one of the second-place tickets. He won $853,000 yesterday. 10-second reactions. Ariana, is it good, bad? What does this mean about the cosmos?
Well,
is this a moral universe?
What I found interesting is that he didn't actually say that he was going to give it to charity. He said he was going to spend it as he and his wife wanted. I think he was going to give some to charity.
But some to a family foundation.
But you kind of expected a millionaire public servant who suddenly wins this kind of money to say who he was going to give it to and what he was going to do with it, but not a bit of it.
Tony, 10 seconds on that?
I think it's always heartwarming when nice things happen to already rich people.
Bob?
Yeah, no one ever mentions, by the way, the judgment of Scripture on gambling. It's sort of gone out as an issue, and I think the whole idea of gambling as somehow the great saving device in this society is a little bit frightening. It's a regressive tax, and I don't want to chuckle about it too much.
I've always myself thought that we should make voting a lottery. It would be a way to get 100% turnout, and it would give us not just, you know, big winners on election night, but the real winners, which would be honoring this random redistribution of wealth that always captures all our attention. We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center end of show rants featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Just about 20 seconds, Tony Blankley. It is your soapbox.
This is a reverse complaint. Well, something wonderful happened in the Senate yesterday. Senator Coburn challenged Senator Stevens' $230 million Bridge to Nowhere perk. He lost, but 11 Republicans and 4 Democrats voted with him. This is the first time that any senators have voted against another senator's perk. And I think it's a wonderful omen because they'll come back again and again, and someday we'll actually be able to cut some of this pork.
15 seconds. Ariana Huffington.
The New York Times was scooped again in its coverage of Blamegate by Mari Wass, who in the National Journal has a great piece about how effectively Fitzgerald sprung a trap for Judy Miller and showed her the documents that showed that she had visited Libby in the executive office on June 23rd, which forced her to testify and find her notes for the second time.
Bob Scheer.
I'd like to know why reporters like Judith Miller, who support the administration, get some special national security clearance, which she claimed she had, that allow them to see documents that the rest of the people can't see, including some members of Congress. I think there has to be that might be the big scandal here. Why was Judy Miller allowed to be with the most secret, embedded in the most secret group and given access to secret information? Was it just because she supported the government's position?
Who is Neil French, this advertising executive in the New York Times business page on Friday, 61-year-old creative director till yesterday of the WPP Group, saying, and it created an uproar, that women aren't rising to the top of advertising because their work isn't good enough because they spend their time as caregivers and childbearers. When will we get rid of these dinosaur men and redesign work at the top in ways that make it possible to have work and life? That's all the work and life we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Bob Scheer, Ariana Huffington, and Tony Blankley. Ray Guarna produced today's show. Our technical director was also Ray Guarna. I'm Matt Miller. Tune in again next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.
You've been listening to KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Le Show, a weekly romp through the worlds of media, politics, sports, and show business with satirist Harry Shearer. Check out the podcast of Le Show at kcrw.com.